Welcome to the A+ EdTech Podcast, the monthly podcast that discusses everything education and EdTech. My name is Ashley McBride, and I am your host. In this episode, we speak with Tavia Clark. Tavia is a digital innovation coach at the Friday Institute, which is a part of NC State's College of Education. Tavia travels across North Carolina, providing professional development for schools to support digital teaching and learning initiatives. Prior to her work with the Friday Institute, Tavia was an English teacher and a librarian. Tavia loves to read, she loves outer space, and she is a self-proclaimed cat person. In our conversation together, Tavia and I spoke about how teachers can better utilize their librarians. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was looking at your Twitter. What is Year of YA?
Oh, okay. So I would love to talk about that. So my friend Molly Holloman and I, she's like one of my best friends. She's a librarian at the beach at Manio Elementary School in the Outer Banks. And we decided that we were going to start a young adult book club, and we were going to do it online because this was back when I was still in the library. And she actually writes, even though she's an elementary librarian, she writes young adult books. And I obviously, as a high school librarian, read a lot of young adult. I could talk to my students about it. And so we just decided we wanted to start a book club. And I don't know if you're familiar with Jennifer Lagarde. So she and Jennifer Northrup.
Well, yeah.
So they were starting Two Gens around the same time that we were going to start Year of Young Adult. And so they had their model. And so Molly and I decided that we just wanted to start something a little bit different. We decided that we were going to start a young adult book club where we would pick a theme, a monthly theme. And then we would do a blog post about the theme, and we would list some resources where you could find book lists, but everyone could choose their own books that they wanted. So you wouldn't necessarily be reading the same books as anyone else. And then we would have a monthly Twitter chat. We would, it was about 5 or 6 questions that dealt with the theme. And we would all talk about all of our books in reference to whatever the month's theme was. And most questions tend to be, it's not like quotes from books. It's nothing like that. It tends to be more about like issues. October's was really funny. We called it pumpkin spice lit because, pumpkin spice latte had just come out. So what we did was, it was like whatever was hip and trendy, because that's like the hip and trendy drink for fall. So whatever is hip and trendy in young adult. And so we just talk about things like, how do we sell young adult to students? How do we advocate for what things they need to see in young adult literature? So like, what is not being written about enough? We talk about ways to share literature with students, or to encourage students to write on their own and, to share their stories, how to link students with authors. How to promote literature in your classroom or your library. We do have a lot of educators that chat with us, but it isn't all educators. We try to keep it kind of education focused because that's sort of the angle we're coming from. And we don't have a huge following, but we do, we get maybe like 10 people or so. I mean, we've had like up to like 30 people, and like people from different countries, that have joined it, over time. I think we've been doing it for like 2 or 3 years now. Like, I can't even remember. It's really, really fun.
I was an English teacher. So I love the idea of a young adult book club because I've read a whole bunch of young adult novels and stuff. But my question is, how could teachers better utilize, especially in secondary, how could they better utilize the library?
I will start by saying that I think a big portion of this depends on the librarian. Just because you're all media coordinators doesn't mean everybody embraces the role the same way. So I think that some of it depends on the type of environment that the librarian sets up. When I was a librarian, I encourage teachers to utilize the library as like an extension of their classroom. And so I constantly try to promote co-teaching experiences where we can work together to do activities, teach lessons. I tried really hard to not just bring technology to the plate, but also bring pedagogy to the plate, because I think that's important. So like new pedagogical strategies, or maybe not new, but just different. And sometimes taking things that seem familiar and making them feel new, because I wanted to you know, let teachers know that I'm about more than just the technology. Like, that's an important piece, and embedding it seamlessly is important. But I wanted them to know that we start with like pedagogy, right? Like, good teaching and learning is part of it. So I think that teachers can, if that person is willing, rely on that librarian. So yeah, so if that person is willing to play that role, I would suggest that teachers utilize it as an extension of their classroom and co-teach, because there are things that as a librarian I can bring to the table that maybe I might be an expert in, where a teacher is an expert in his or her content area, right? And I might not be, but I can be an expert in other things like digital citizenship and just different things like that. So I would you know, say that that's a great way to utilize a library. I mean, as far as ELA is concerned, obviously utilizing that person as a go-to resource for literature. I would call myself a book whisperer. I love Donald Miller's books, The Book Whisperer and Reading in the Wild. And when I read those, they changed my teaching life, like 100%. And so I'm a huge advocate for a free choice in reading, you know, throwing away class novels, not throwing the books away, but like throwing out the class novel kind of pedagogy and letting kids choose what they want to read. And so the last school that I was at before I went to Friday Institute, you know, I brought that with me. And I had one of my English teacher friends who also came to the school at the same time I did, does that model for her classroom. And so we brought that to the school. And so I was able to have the English teachers, for the most part, utilize me as not just for co-teaching experiences, but also as a resource for all things young adult lit.
How did you guys work with, because I remember when I was teaching, I did do a lot of the units where everybody was reading the same book, or I pieced it together with them. And everything. How do you get students who are normally not readers engaged to go out on their own and read? Because one of the problems I always had was I hadn't read that book, and so I don't know if they're, you know, telling me a lie whenever they start doing some sort of project, right, or something. And I mean, I could look into it, but honestly, there's 140 kids and only one of me and 140 mm-hmm. books, and the odds of me having read all of them would be. So how did you guys set this up? Because now I'm really interested in that.
So yes, that's the first question. I actually just did some PD on this at the schools that I work with from Friday, like through Friday Institute. And so that's the first question we always get is, how do you know that they read? My answer 100% of the time is always going to be, because I let them talk to me about what they read. I let them talk to each other about what they read. They write about what they read. And I think to some extent, we have to stop assuming kids are going to do the wrong thing and start giving them the opportunity to do the right thing. And so we have to let go of control and stop feeling like we have to have read every book, and we have to test and quiz them to death to make sure that they're actually comprehending what they're reading, and just let them read for pleasure. Let them build confidence in their choice to pick books that they actually will enjoy, and give them the opportunity to share what they're reading, whether that means they're pair sharing, whether that means we're doing book commercials, maybe we're doing, they're writing about what they're reading. Maybe they're writing to me about what they're reading, whatever the protocol that you want to use, whatever, giving them the opportunity to not just show us they are knowing what they're reading by taking a quiz, but also applying that through conversation and through writing. So the way that we would do it is we would start, like, for instance, we'd start this semester, we'll say, because we're high school, so, you know, we're block schedule. So we would start the semester with kind of challenging the kids, you know, you're going to, your goal is 20 books for this semester, and you get to pick all the books you want to read. And then we sort of introduce them to genres. You know, we have a discussion about what genres are, because part of the thing is kids, especially when they get to high school, have not had much choice in what they read. They've generally at that point been told what they're going to read. The most choice they've probably ever had was in elementary school, and then it's still under so many constraints because it's generally under reading levels. You have to read certain things for AR, that kind of thing. So they've never really been given the opportunity to build their confidence as someone, as a reader, as somebody who can pick like a book that's going to work for them. Like, they've never been given the opportunity other than just maybe very quickly taken to the library and said, get something for SSR and let's go back to the room. And I might have time to read once a week or whatever, but we're not promoting that as passionate time, right? So we start by talking about genres. We do just, you know, some different acts surrounded by genres. And then they would always come to the library within the first week of school. And we do a really book tasting and speed dating with books. And we'd make it fun. We'd celebrate it. It was great. And generally what I would do is to sort of, piggyback off of the discussion about genres that they would have had in her class, I will set up genre tables in the library. And so I'll just take and put like interesting signs up, and I'll set up tables that have all kinds of different genres, but not things just like historical fiction and horror. Like I'll do things like, if you liked this movie, read this book. Things that will actually speak to them. I'll think about like what they like from YouTube. I'll think about the TV shows that are big at that point. And I'll make genre tables that kind of go along with those things as well. And so we'll set up genre tables because some kids will go right to the shelves and they have complete confidence in their ability to look at 1,000 books and pick one that they like. But what I find most of the time is that a lot of the kids, when they go into the library, especially if you have a really well-stocked library, even if it's beautiful, even if you have it set up and it looks like Barnes and Noble, it's very overwhelming. And like what kids end up doing is they just end up pulling things off and looking at the covers and saying, I like the cover, so I'll read it. So, and that's fine because that's the way that some people choose. And so we honor, like we would honor whatever way they want to choose a book, right? We would honor it. But we set up the genre tables because for a lot of kids, that makes it a little less overwhelming. It scaffolds it a little bit so that they feel like they can go right to where they feel comfortable. And so we kind of close the whole library off and, you know, just let the class in there and it becomes their space. We also sometimes do speed dating. So sometimes we'll have them start at the genre tables and we'll give them, have this little form that we would give them, and it uses emojis and they have to speed date with books, and we'll do it in rounds, and like maybe they'll start at one genre table and then we'll just kind of, you know, like ping pong around the room. They might stay at one table for like 2 or 3 minutes and then they'll go to the next table and the next table, and they just keep track of books that they think that they find interesting. And then at the end of the speed date, they go back and they, you know, they have a real date with the book that they liked the most. And the high school kids love that. I mean, you can use the dating analogy obviously with them, and they love the emoji thing. It's really cute.
Do you give students some sort of guide when they're doing the speed dating? Because I'm picturing some kids might, you know, just be flipping through. They might look to see how many pages are in it. Because like you said, they have this, at least in the beginning, they have this preconceived notion that I don't want too many pages, or I don't want tiny words. Or so do you give them some sort of guideline for how to speed date?
So what we do is we 100% scaffold, and we have discussions about everything. So we talk prior to them coming to the library. I generally will go in her class as we're having the genre discussions. We will also talk about how we choose books, and we'll have that discussion. And so I'll be honest, like, this is how I choose books. Like, if I'm overwhelmed, I look at the cover. And if the cover looks good, I might read the back. And sometimes I don't even read the back. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, the cover looks good, so I'll try it. And we talk about how we choose books, and we talk about the positives and negatives of choosing books certain ways. And we just have very real conversations, and we tell them, you know, if you know that a 500 page book is not where you need to start, don't choose a 500 page book. It's okay to choose a 100 page book. If that's what you need as a reader, then start there, and that's fine, right? Because part of what we're trying to do is not only give them confidence in their choice to choose books, but we're also trying to help them build reading stamina, right? Because that's what's going to help them in other endeavors, like the nasty testing word, right? So like, we want to give them reading stamina. We want to create passionate readers who literally can read anything and stick with it. Because they're not always going to be able to read what they choose. So we do have conversations about that. While they're speed dating, the form kind of scaffolds it a little bit for them. They don't get much time. It's very quick. So if I have a genre table, I might have 20 books on that table. They're only going to get like 2 minutes at that table. So they're not going to be able to look at everything. And what they do is they pick one or two books while they're at that table, write down the title, the author. They look like flip through very quickly, and then they give it a rating. And it would be something like maybe a thumbs up if like I think I might want to get to know you better. Maybe a heart if I think I'm in love. You know, it's kind of like themed like a date here. And then they have to give me a really like a one sentence why. And some kids will say like the cover looked good and it's only 150 pages. Like it's doable for me. And I think that's okay. Like, I think that if that's what they need as a reader to like get them hooked and to help them feel like the book that they're choosing is the right book for themselves, then I'm okay with that, because the magic comes in having them get that one book that sets off that passion for reading. And I don't want to stack the cards against them. So I don't want to hand them a 500-page book if really what they need is 150 pages. Because a lot of it is the attitude they bring to that reading, right? So like, they like the cover, it looks doable, it doesn't look overwhelming for them, then I want them to take that book, right? And if it's more of a middle school level book, I don't care. Because guess what? They're reading. And they've chosen that book for themselves, you know? And so we don't put a lot of stipulations on it. We really give them the opportunity to kind of choose for them. We also have conversations about abandoning books, which I know a lot of people would turn their nose up. But, you know, I know, and I have a real conversation with them. You know, I only have 20 hours in my day. And if I start reading a book and get like 5 or 6 chapters in and I cannot connect with the book, doesn't mean it's a terrible book. I can't connect with it. Then I'll abandon it and I'll find something else that I can connect with. So we talk to them about that. We give them the space and the freedom to be able to make that choice as a reader, because I don't want them to stick with something if it really isn't something they can connect with.
Right. And I'm glad you do that, because I remember when I was teaching, I had some ninth graders, and there was a point where we were reading a book together. My school didn't have a library. I had like this small little library of my own, but we were reading a book together as a class, and I remembered I loved the book, but then we get like 2 chapters in, they're lost, they're not interested. And I just said, okay, guys. So we had a real conversation, and I just said, we're just going to abandon this book. And we talked about what that looked like. And I told them, you know, at a different, I gave them a synopsis of the whole, of the book as I remembered it. And I said, you know, when you get a little bit older, maybe you'll enjoy it. Or if you, you know, just think about the fact that you might like this sometime later on down the road. And we moved on to something else. So I think there's an importance in that, because honestly, in the real world, if we're readers to be readers, we're not gonna just pick up something and force ourselves through it. We're gonna put it down if we don't like it. So I like that you do that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really about like having those conversations, because I think sometimes we have unreal expectations for our students. And one of the things, so once we get a book, everybody gets a book, right? Like we've done that. One of the things is, if you read Book Whisperer and Reading in the Wild, like Donald and Miller, she kind of sets up the way that she like approaches, like she uses this approach in her classroom. And so one of the things that we do, or I should say my friend, because I was in the library, you know, I wasn't in the English classroom at this point. But one of the things that she does when she structures her class is we had 90-minute blocks, 87-minute blocks, you know, because of the high school bell schedule. And so she, every single day, they have a dedicated 30 minutes of reading time. Every single day, because one of the things that we don't do often enough, we tell our kids that they need to be readers, and we expect them to be readers, and we expect them to read, but we never give them the chance to practice it. And it's like when I read her book and I thought about that, it blew my mind, because I thought, you know, how rarely I ever gave in my English classroom, I rarely gave my kids time to actually like dedicated time in class to practice reading, like to read, because we were too busy doing, you know, synthesizing and analyzing the literature, or doing grammar, or doing right. vocabulary, or doing writing, you know, and we didn't make space and time for actual reading. So that's one of the things that like every day she does, they get 30 minutes of reading time, and she may stop them at about 25 minutes, and then they'll generally write down real quick. They have like a reading log where they just put like where they stopped, so they'll remember the next day. And they might do pair shares. They might do book talks. They might do book commercials. They may just have a class, a real quick, like, hey, who wants to share something awesome that they read in their book? And one of the things that does is it starts to create a community of readers. It's very important as well, because we never give kids time to read, and we also never give them time to talk about what they read, you know? And not like, I don't mean like we're reading a whole class novel, let's have a discussion with some questions that I put up on the board. I mean to talk about like what they like and don't like about their reading. I think that that's very important to kind of allow that time and space for that. And one of the things that was very interesting when we first started doing this years ago we would do book commercials. And so basically with a book commercial, it'd be about a minute. The kids would be able to volunteer to get in front of the class, and they could share just kind of almost like a movie trailer. You share like a little bit about the book, but you don't give everything away. You can do it at any point within the book. So you can wait till the book's over with. A lot of kids like to do that because that gives them more to talk about. But some kids that were really excited would do it like three times while they're reading a book. But one of the cool things that happened, and I actually have like, I have a video example. It's really cool. So we had these two girls in honors English, 10th grade honors English, that both read A Child Called It. And so they both finished it about the same time. They wanted to do a book commercial. But the interesting thing about the book commercial was that they, one loved the book and one hated it.
Oh, wow.
And so they got in, we gave them the opportunity to get in front of the class and to do a book commercial and together. And we gave the one that didn't like the book that freedom and space to talk about she didn't like the book. And it was almost kind of magical because she didn't say like it was a terrible book or it wasn't well written. She got up and talked about, as a reader, for her, the subject matter was too difficult to digest. Mm-hmm. It hurt her heart. It made her feel bad. And she finished the book barely, but she didn't like it because it was too real. And so we saw when we allowed that to happen, it was almost as if the kids kind of became more empowered, right? They became empowered to be able to talk about what they don't like and what they're reading. And it was kind of magical. I mean, I think that it was a really cool moment in that class. Yeah.
I remember reading that book. I was an adult when I read that book, and it was it's tough subject matter to get through. It really is.
Right.
We've talked a lot about how you worked with English teachers. What types of things could the math, science, or social studies teachers utilize the librarian for?
Definitely co-teaching opportunities. I would say, I can only speak from my own experience and the kind of things that I would bring to the table, but I worked a lot with social studies history teachers in doing activities like written conversations, for instance, to break down hard texts, especially primary source documents and things like that. But any kind of co-teaching experiences or any type of inquiry-based learning experiences that you're doing, any time when kids need to do research of any type or inquiry, they need to create questions, they need to look at the validity of sources, where to find things, how to determine whether a resource is actually what they need. Not just whether it's good or not, but whether it's what they need. Any of those types of things, I think, are great opportunities. Also, if you're planning on having them create a product of any type, at any point that product is going to utilize technology, I think it's awesome to include the librarian in that. We generally tend to be like purveyors of ed tech, and we try to do, so I think that it's awesome if you can take advantage of that person in that capacity, because the things that we can do we can help you design things, but we can also model the use of those tools, and not just model the use of those tools, but model the ethical use of those tools. So if we're talking about creating something, especially like, let's say a video, for instance, model how to use the tool ethically by making sure that your get that is copyright free. We can kind of pull some of that digital citizenship stuff in there, things that classroom teachers might not be experts in because they're experts like in their content area. Anything with literacy strategies, generally most librarians are more than happy to help with that.
So do you have any digital citizenship suggestions since you brought it up? I mean,
sure.
Anything you've done in the past?
Well, so I can say that my first thing that I will suggest, and I actually said this to a group of like 60 teachers the other day in front of the superintendent.
Of course she did.
I would say that, of course I did, right? I would say that one of the things that we have to start doing is we have to start giving kids the opportunity to do the right thing and stop like closing off opportunities because we're afraid they're going to do the wrong thing. So we have to open ourselves up to allowing them to utilize tools. And like for older kids, that might mean letting them dive into the idea of using social media for activism or using social media in an academic way. You know, I think that we have to model good digital citizenship by having tough conversations. So if I plan to do a Twitter chat with my kids, or, you know, maybe we're doing a discussion and we're going to have a back channel through a Twitter chat, then I need to actually model what that looks like. I need to bring Twitter up. I need to show them how I would respond to things, and I need to give them, you know, we need to have some talks about like what, you know, how we give each other feedback and what that looks like in 140 character. Well, I guess 208 characters now. And, you know, model some of those good behaviors. I think they need to see it in action. We are doing research. And I try to always like model the use of online databases. Like, how do I look for things? How do I find the things that I need? How do I tell the difference between real news and fake news? I'm using images.
How do you tell the difference between real news and fake news? That's the $1 million question right now, isn't it?
You know, being able to understand bias. You know, that's a really big thing. Like, you know, and when it's okay to use something that has bias, and when it's not okay, and you know, how we have to scaffold that and what we're creating, like what our product is.
I had a teacher who he had tried Twitter before. So he was having a political discussion, or he had students who were running for president in his class. And so he had this big political campaign going on, and he allowed them to use Twitter, and they set up a hashtag, and he had never used it before. And he was letting the kids kind of run with it. And then some posts came up in the middle of the night that he didn't see until the next morning that were not appropriate. And then, of course, he was able to get them pulled down and all of that. So he was really gung-shy. So one thing that we did, so one thing that we did was I suggested he open a brand new Google Classroom and allow students to post and reply to each other as a way to kind of start that conversation before they move in. He said it was good. Like the kids were, and it also allowed him to invite students from other classes. So then it was a closed version of a chat. So that's one thing that we did in order to kind of to bridge that gap, because I know there are some districts, and ours is one of them, that we've started, students can't get on Twitter on their personal devices. They can on the school devices because we see the academic piece to it, but on their personal devices, mainly because they're on it all the time, and the bandwidth with so many students and so many devices, if every single cell phone plus every single laptop is on streaming on Twitter, because some of those videos just play on their own, and it just eats the bandwidth. We had kids last year who were kicked off of tests because the bandwidth was just maxed out, and it became a problem. So we had to find a way to par that down a little bit. But I think there's ways around it. If teachers aren't comfortable, they can find a different way to.
Yeah, great. And I think that that's an important message. And when I work with schools and districts, because I'm on Twitter all the time, Twitter has been a game changer for me professionally. And so I'm, you know, always preach Twitter and how wonderful it is and all of that. But I understand that some people do have reservations, and I totally get it. In working with high school kids, that's all of my experience other than at FI being able to have experiences with different grade levels. But when I was in the classroom and in the library, it was all high school. And I think sometimes it's easy to have tunnel vision when you work with older kids and you just think, oh yeah, you know, they can handle it. And sometimes they can and sometimes they can't. But I do think that it's good, like that if the teacher's comfort level, if they need it more scaffolded, then something like Google Classroom is awesome. Utilizing something like Seesaw, you know, a tool like that where the kids are accountable because they are logged in under their name.
I think that's a good point of possibly using Seesaw too. It allows for the videos and all of that as well. And also, I ran into something this year. A student's parents didn't want her to have a portfolio online, like didn't want her to have anything online. And it gets kind of hard whenever you're trying to do student portfolios and you're trying to do blogs and you're trying to do all these things. And then there's this stop of, no, I don't want anything. Like, I'm hardly comfortable with the Google account the school is making them have. So that's another consideration, is trying to find a way around to make parents comfortable, because I know that if my kids, and they're really young, they're not on social media yet, but, I just can't imagine. I know their inability to see something as a bad idea now. I can't imagine what it's going to be in middle school when they've got a phone in their hand and they have little toy phones and stuff right now that they snap pictures and they send text messages and, oh goodness, I just... So,
well, and you're totally right. Like, and I think that part of the problem is that we are so quick to say no, no, no to everything because, and not because we don't want them to have experience, but because we want to protect them. Mm-hmm. And we don't just want to protect them from other people. We want to protect them from themselves, you know? And so sometimes it's easier when we're talking about thousands of students in school, it's much easier to just say no than it is to do the hard work and have the hard conversations that allow them to make the right choices. And so I think that it's about taking something that is so familiar to them. I mean, they use social media from such a young age. And even though little kids generally are not using social media, they know what Instagram is. Like, right. My niece and nephew know what Instagram is. They don't have Instagram accounts, but they know their mom does. And they know that their aunt does. And, you know, like, they know that I post on there. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do is to start sort of changing the narrative and having them understand that, you know, there's different uses for these tools. And when we just say no all the time, we're never giving them the opportunity to use these tools in a way that's amplifying their voice for a different reason. Whether it's to tell their story or whether it's to talk about the thing we're learning, or whether it's to have opinions about things that in the world or in society matter to them, to take a stand on something. You know, I don't think we're doing enough to take advantage of the opportunity that some of those tools can have for that. And when they're little, obviously, it does mean starting analog, because they're just not, I mean, they're not off to use the tool, period. It goes against the tool's terms and agreements, right? I mean, most of those tools, you have to be, at least 13 mm-hmm. or so before you, right? It's usually 13. And so it does mean maybe starting in an analog way. And maybe it's not mimicking Twitter, but maybe it's teaching kids how to give each other actionable feedback that is more than just criticizing ideas, or is more than just saying that's awesome or that's great. You know, maybe it starts with having discussions about how we talk to each other about like the work that we're doing or about the opinions that we're having. And I think that, you know, we just have to kind of take better advantage of the opportunities that the technology gives us. Look at it as a way to teach them important and valuable skills while they're young. Because I'm going to be honest with you, if they're going to make a mistake, I'd prefer for them to make a mistake when I'm there to help talk them through it, or when I'm there to help them make sure that they grasp the lesson from that mistake, rather than them make a mistake when they're 18 or 19 and there are serious repercussions for their mistake. Not that the repercussions in high school wouldn't be serious, but they have some scaffolding built in there. Like, we can actually have some conversations with them about like what they've done and, you know, how we could fix it or what we could have better.
I love that you brought up, and I'm actually reading a research study on feedback, on peer feedback. And it was a group of adults that were giving feedback to each other as part of a class. So the first 6 weeks, the professor gives all the feedback, but he models it for them. And to even have to do that for adults, I mean, and then they talk about in there how the adults were uncomfortable because they felt like either they weren't qualified or they didn't feel comfortable giving feedback to somebody else that was in their class, that they'd rather the professor do it. I think you have a really good point of how we could utilize social media to train them that how to provide good, positive, and complete feedback, as opposed to, like you said, this is awesome, or I didn't like this, or I disagree with you. Or, and another point is, I think we need to be training, and this is a conversation my husband and I were having this afternoon, we really need to be training kids how to disagree with each other in a way that they feel it's okay that someone disagrees with them. And it's not, I think, and what you were saying about having them explore their own books and explore social media and allowing them to come up with some of their own things, but then also have that disagreement, like the two girls with the child called it. Because if we keep hammering students in this testing society that we're in, that there's only one right answer, and if you don't get it right, you're wrong. That's not the way we live in. That's not the world we live in. We live in a gray world, not black and white.
Well, and that's another thing is, like, I think it's, you know, I'm going to just say that I think it's our duty. I mean, as educators, like, we have kids sometimes longer than their parents have them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, we have more opportunity to talk to them in their day than sometimes their parents do. And I think that we have to teach them what discourse is. We have to teach them how to agreeably disagree. And the fact that, they can do that in a way where, we can take emotion out of it. And we can, we can look at it as a discourse as opposed to looking at it as a disagreement, right?
Right.
And I don't know what the perfect answer is for that, but I do know that I think social media and the idea of social media and the fact that they're very comfortable with it and that they're using it already, I just think it gives us a very good platform to start talking about what discourse is. And it also, with what's going on in our world, I think there's plenty of examples of what discourse isn't. And so I Right. think, that we have to be utilizing like the tools that are around so that we can teach them how to have discourse. And they're only going to, it's only going to be positive impact by getting them to understand that they can talk to each other and they can take criticism, and it doesn't mean that you have to be emotionally charged afterwards, right?
So what was your absolute favorite lesson that you've co-taught with a teacher?
Probably with that same English teacher. She is like one of my like teacher best friends. And so we taught English 2 together for a while before I moved to the library. So I would say she always does a big inquiry-based learning project in humanities. And so throughout the world, because it's 10th grade English, it's world lit. So I think probably that particular inquiry project, which has different iterations each year depending on the group of kids, because you have to kind of approach inquiry-based learning differently depending on your kids, their level and, all of that. But it's really fun. We kind of approach it the same way that we do with any kind of book of choice. We will set up the library and instead of genre tables, we'll pull out books that deal with inhumanity. And this could be anything from historical fiction to memoir and autobiography to nonfiction to graphic novels. We just pull anything that deals with inhumanities because the way that we approach it is the book is really just the catalyst for whatever it is that they're interested in and that they want to learn more about. So the book is not the research. The book is the trigger for the question that they'll go and research. So we're okay with them reading something that's fiction or like that's loosely based on like historical fiction that's based on real events, because it's more about getting them interested in something. So for instance, let's say they read a book, like Sold. I don't know if you've heard of that book. It's kind of like a middle school book. Let's say they talk about human trafficking. So whether the book is fiction or not, that issue is a real issue. And so if that book that they're very interested in shines some kind of light on an issue, like an inhumanity, then that's what they would, create their inquiry-based learning question. And that's where they go, like their research, you know, that's like sort of the path that they take. So I really, really love that unit that we do. And we co-teach the whole thing. So, you know, I do a lot with like getting the books in their hands and kind of helping them through that process. I do a lot with helping her to scaffold, devising the inquiry-based learning question. We chunk it. We take it very slow. We make sure that we're giving them the time and the space that they need in order to, not just jump right into research, but to take their question and see where their question leads. Because they start with one question and generally they end up, their inquiry-based learning question tends to end up being something else, because they start with something and then it takes them down different paths and they find a piece that they're very interested in. I do a lot with when they started doing research, like helping them write thesis statements. So I got to kind of play the English teacher a little bit, which was really fun. When we moved into the actual research portion, I got to show, I do a lot with showing them where to find resources, like what database. I mean, a lot of kids, like, they don't know what a database is. They don't understand the value of using a database as opposed to just going to Google and, just typing in human trafficking and seeing what you get. So I get to show them some different resources, get to help them do annotated bibliographies, which is really fun. And that's probably like the dorkiest statement ever, but that's always really fun, because I like making them think about the intention behind a resource that they're choosing to use. And generally it culminates in a multimedia presentation. And that looks different sometimes for different kids, but it's really fun because I get to go over with them kind of what a good presentation looks like, and what it doesn't look like, and how you can capture your audience and those types of things. So that's probably like my favorite things, because it was long. It takes a long time. We work in written conversation. I mean, there's just a lot of different things that I love that we get to work in, a lot of different pedagogical strategies that she lets me be a part of. And so you really get to connect with the kids too. You get to build relationships, because when you work with them, once or twice a week for a couple of months, they kind of become your kids too. So I love that we're having kids think about something outside of their own lives. And a lot of times kids don't realize, what's going on in the world until they start reading about it or they start doing some research on it. So it's always nice to see like kind of the light bulbs go off when they realize that there are children. A lot of times, because they will end up doing things that affect kids, right? Because they're kids. And when they start seeing that there are some things going on that they had no idea, they start to become passionate about things, and that's always really great.
I think books are a fantastic way. I used to tell my students all the time that books allow you to experience something there's no other way you can experience.
Yeah, because books are windows and mirrors, right? So they're mirrors to help us see ourselves, right? To help us see ourselves and know that we're not alone in situations. And it's also windows. They illuminate us to things that are going outside of ourselves. And so I think that it's really important to allow books to be a catalyst for that. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me. So if anybody wanted to find you, how would they do that? Like, what's your Twitter handle? What's your website?
I'm very active on Twitter. So if you want to find me on Twitter, it's just Tavia, T-A-V as in Victor, I-A underscore Clark, just my first and last name. Same on Instagram. My website is just taviaclark.com. It's not super duper exciting. I have a couple of things up there that I've written, and I'm trying to write more, so I'm trying to get better. I'm actually working on a piece right now that's going to get published soon on written conversations and some of the work that we did through DLCN with the Institute on that. So, that's how they can find me, and I'm just Tavia Clark on Facebook. So,
all right. Well, I like your blog. I was on it before we started talking, which is how I found that. That year of YA thing that you were doing. And if anybody wanted to join that, could they?
Yes, anyone can. We have a shortened link for it. It's just bit.ly/year of YA. And so it'll take you to the blog, and we have a post every month for what we're doing. And we invite anyone to join Twitter chat, generally like Tuesday or Wednesday of the month. But yeah, so anyone can join in. The theme is up there. You can read one book, you can read 10 books, you can read no books. The way that we set up the chat is really great, that you always have something to say, like even if you didn't read the book, because we talk about generally bigger issues, and how we help students deal with issues or promote issues or whatever. So you can join in even if you're not a huge young adult reader.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Tavia one more time for taking the time to talk to me. I had an amazing time talking to her, and there was so much good stuff. I really had a hard time editing this episode. So I'm hoping Tavia will be able to come back and talk to me again, maybe in some bigger group conversations or even just one-on-one with some other topics. If you want to find all of Tavia's information, her website, the Year of YA, go to aplusedtech.com, and all the information you need will be found in the show notes.